You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and I'm very proud to be talking today to an American comedy giant. He is literally quite tall and frequently noted, more importantly, as the number one comic on Twitter. If you haven't heard of him, just take a minute now or whenever you can to look at @RobDelaney, look at his Twitter feed, and get a sense of how comprehensively this guy has created a voice and a whole approach to the medium of comedy on Twitter. He's just nailing it 24/7. And we're going to find out how. Recorded live at the Gilded Balloon in Edinburgh, this is Rob Delaney.
Thanks, man. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you for having me.
I sort of feel like for the posterity of the way podcasts work, we should probably act as if this place is absolutely packed.
Oh, it is? Well, it is packed. In my heart, I've decided.
Yeah, there we go. But we'll
you just decide, you know? That's what one thing you have to do as a comedian, yeah. Is be like, no, it's great. I mean, it's not great, but you decide it's great.
Well, thank you. That's very big-hearted of you. So tell me, I saw your show last night. You're in Edinburgh for just the two nights, tonight.
Last night and tonight. Yeah.
And this is a whistle-stop tour. How long are you in the UK for in total?
2 days here, 2 days in London, and then Leeds and Reading festivals.
Okay.
So just like a week.
Okay. And how many times have you been to the UK before? I saw you in London last year.
This is my fourth visit in 12 months. Okay. So I've been here a lot in the last year.
Okay. And how are you finding, this is a crap opening question. I assure you it'll get deeper, but how are you finding UK audiences?
Magnificent. And it's not a crap, it would be a crap question if we were just in Cincinnati for one night. If this was a Cincinnati radio morning show and you're like, sure. How are you finding Cincinnati? I'd be like, I don't know. I just got off the plane at the airport and came here. But since I've been here a lot, I love it. And the audience has been wonderful. And yeah, I mean, the fact that I've been back four times in a year, you know, suggests that I've enjoyed myself.
Sure.
Otherwise, I'd be a masochist. So yeah, I love it and love to come back and hope that my next time back is soon.
Excellent. And the show that you're doing at the moment, I mean, most people that come to Edinburgh perform a specific show written for Edinburgh. Is that what you're doing, or is this?
Absolutely not. No,
okay.
I made no sort of concessions of any kind. my first hour long stand up special came out at the end of last year, and now I'm working on the new one. And so it's just about me and my life, and it does adhere to a sort of narrative arc, I suppose, mostly, you know, at least at the very least, everything's pretty thematically united, but it isn't, you know, there's no purpose to it. You know, I don't want people to learn anything or go on any kind of emotional journey that's worth anything.
Sure.
So
okay, so is it just, it's a case of, you're using the UK dates to run in stuff ahead of your next special?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Totally.
And will you be changing the material that you do tonight compared to last night? Or is it a case of you go, I want this stuff to work, similar. So I'm going to train it?
But you know what? I would actually like to reverse, since this is the Comics Comic podcast.
It's the Comedian's Comedian podcast. I believe someone already has Comics Comic.
I just wanted to shorten it for brevity.
Feel free.
No, the Comedian's Comedian. I will say, you said, is this warm up for that? Not really, because the special isn't, I think, really the purpose of, or it's not my, like, MO. You know, the live shows are the thing. And sure. then you document, you know, and you always want to be heading towards something that is united and, you know, mature and sure. goes from A to Z in a nice way. So, but the fact is, you know, you put out specials. Honestly, you put out specials. You try to do stand-up on TV. You try to get all these opportunities. Really, I mean, I do it so that I can sell more tickets on the road, so that mm-hmm. I can perform more. Because live performing is it, you sure. know? I mean, of course, you want to be proud of your special and stuff, and it is a, you know, sort of a living document. I guess it's not living. It's dead because it's static. Or it, sure. it can't be changed once it's been set down to celluloid or digital pixels or whatever. But so, yeah, I just like to do live stand-up, and everything sure. else that I do is just to support that.
Okay. So just, and I know your the beginnings of your process have been, the beginnings of your work as a stand-up comedian have been fairly well documented. I've read a few interviews with you. I've listened to the mm-hmm. podcast you did with Maren and mm-hmm. with on the Mental Illness Happy Hour as mm-hmm. well. But just for the sake of my listenership, if you could just sketch out
sure.
how you yeah. came to it, because it's an incredible story.
Well, I've been doing stand-up now for just over 10 years, so I'm new, mm-hmm. and I am only beginning to figure out even the most basics, you know.
Sure.
And, you know, new stand-ups ask me, they'll say, like, well, hey, I'm going to do stand-up for, like, the first time, or I've been doing it for a few weeks, what should I do? And I always say to them, like, this is my advice, is you should take the microphone out of the stand, because mm-hmm. it'll like free up your body, and the mind and the body are connected, so you might feel a little looser just generally. Speak louder than you think you need to, and speak slower than you want to, you know? So you should almost be yelling okay. slowly okay. with a microphone that is out of the stand. And you should be looking at the audience, and if that's too scary for you, which I understand and appreciate, then look above their heads.
Sure.
Don't look at the ground. Take the mic out of the stand. Be loud and be slow.
Okay.
And they're like, but what about the material? I'm like, there's no help. It's going to suck. In the beginning, yeah, your material okay. just doesn't matter. Just say sure. what you're going to say unapologetically and act like you think, at least, it's funny. And then maybe you'll con some of the audience into believing that. But those things take a long time to learn, you know? Sure. I mean, even last night, I went too fast. Mm-hmm. I had 60 minutes to do the show. My show, I've been doing longer than that of late, so I tried to cram it all in. Mm-hmm. And afterwards, I knew. I was like, that was a little fast. That was mm-hmm. a little fast. I okay. slow down. So...
I find whenever newer comics, and through this podcast, I've been a comic.
Quickly, I just want to say I didn't answer your question at all. I
don't sure, know that's okay. That's that. Fine. We'll take okay. it on the fly. That's fine. I've been doing stand-up for about 9 years. And mm-hmm. Since I've started doing this podcast, I get lots of people asking me, you know, I get lots of new comics saying, what's your advice?
Right.
And I try to take a similar tack whereby mm-hmm. The thing I most often tell them, I don't do any of that sort of useful, practical stuff that you've mentioned. But the thing I always say to people is don't take anyone's advice. And for me, that's like a conscious choice. And I wonder, is that the same for you, to basically say, you know, stand-up seems to me to be about being as different as you possibly can from anyone else. So mm-hmm. you don't want to hear how someone else
sure.
kind of thinks you should do it.
Sure.
So is that a similar sort of idea? You want to steer clear of actually giving them material advice?
Well, what you said is it's very valid. And then I think even sort of an umbrella over both our advices is screw who cares what we think.
Yeah,
you know what
absolutely.
I mean?
Sure.
Which is a version of what you've said, but like you can't be helped if you're damaged enough to think like maybe I should do stand up. Then you can't be helped. You can't be given advice. I think the only thing that anybody could, you know, you have to do it a million times, roughly, sure. you know, round down a little bit, but like you have to do it so many times because you're just not going to be good out of the gate, you know, because there's nowhere to practice other than in front of a live audience. You can't practice in front of your computer. It doesn't matter if you're funny on Twitter, for example. It doesn't matter if you're funny at the dinner table with your friends. You've got to get up there and fail mightily, just crash and burn and bleed and cry. You have to cry in the kitchen of a comedy club while like waiters are like, what? Oh God. And not helping. Nobody comes up to hug you. They're just like, sure. hopefully he'll quit.
Yeah.
And then 1,000 terrible things have to happen to you and you just have to keep going. It's a combination of positive character attributes like work ethic, but then it's negative ones too. Like you should have quit. You know what I mean? Like so many times when you should really quit, when a sane person would, you just don't. So if you can go at it to the detriment of your health, relationships, and all this stuff, then maybe you might make it. But statistically, probably not.
Probably not still. Yeah. But you mentioned the idea of being a damaged person, if you're damaged enough to do it. Now, is that a sort of a casual kind of riff on the idea that, you know, there's this sort of tears of a clown idea that stand-ups are damaged? Or is that something that you actually believe, that there is, that you have to be broken somehow to want to go out and
not
keep doing
it? Broken
to
the point of not being functional, but you do, your disorder, like if you, like the Kinsey Institute on Sexuality, I think maybe they were in Minnesota. For the purposes of this podcast, they're in Minnesota. They would talk, like Kinsey would steer people away from saying something was bad or good. He just wanted people to use like common or rare. You know, so he didn't want to shame people who were like, I like to put my penis in a kid's sweater because it's tiny and feels good. I don't know why I thought of that. I've never done that. I've never put my penis in a kid's sweater. But you know what I mean? Like, so he didn't want you to be like, whoa, sweater guy. He would just be like, hey, not a lot of people do that. You know,
sure.
So okay. I think with comedians, you know, something is off and you're in a very small minority. If you want to stand in front of people, which is scary already to a normal person, and then if you want to make them laugh, that's like crazy. That's pathological. Something's up, you know. I like that and I want to be around people who want to do that, but it's rare and it's odd. And it is often attended, I think, by other, you know, things that might be called a character defect or something.
So when you started doing stand-up, it was... Now, I wanted to sort of clear up the timeline because I know you had a very serious car accident.
Correct,
Driving whilst drunk.
Yes.
And I know that you have suffered and do still suffer from depression.
Correct.
And I'd like to know between those, did either of those things launch you into stand-up? Was stand-up something you considered before doing that?
Yeah, I'm 36. I went to New York University, and my senior year of college in 1998, I was studying musical theater at NYU. I wanted to do musical theater, and the first half of my senior year, I saw the Upright Citizens Brigade do improv in New York City. And that really changed my life, being so physically close to such amazing comedy energy. I said, I must do that. I have to do that.
Okay.
So that's 1998. Right before I graduated in 1999, I booked a big part in a national tour of a Broadway show. So I did that for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And so I was young enough where I couldn't say no to like a steady job. So I couldn't stay in New York and, you know, pursue the dream of becoming a comedian. Then I got back
That was a musical theater job. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And then I got back to New York and I signed up for classes at the Upright Citizens Brigade. But then I started getting more work. And then I moved to L.A. in the middle of 2001. And then in the beginning of 2002, I drank into a blackout, and then I was in a big car accident, just me in a building, and a lot of surgeries, broke both my arms pretty badly. My legs were damaged but not broken, and so then I was in the care of the state of California for a while, and when I got out, at the sort of end of 2002, I went and saw a Groundlings show in Los Angeles, and I said, oh yeah, that thing that I wanted to do, maybe now I can. And since I felt I had sort of had a, you know, kind of a archetypal second chance kind of a thing happen, so I said, you know what, this is what I most want to do, I'm going to do it. And then I started doing improv at the Improv Olympic in L.A., and did hundreds of shows there, and then shifted into stand-up.
Okay.
At the end of 2002, beginning of 2003, and that provided sort of the highest high and sort of intrigued me the most creatively, and I've been doing it since.
So when you were initially doing improv and then you first stepped on a stage to do stand up, did you take pre-prepared material on with you, or were you thinking I'll improv my way?
No, I absolutely did. So 10, 11 years ago, I would have been explicitly prepared, with written stuff or beat it out stuff, you know, and, I sure don't do that anymore.
Okay. But. Well, I mean, to look at the way that it's changed, let's just focus for a moment on how you would write then. I mean, were you coming to it? Did anyone sort of suggest you, this is how you write stand up, or did you go, okay, I'm going to make some notes and then.
That's what I would do. I would just make notes. I would say, okay, I'm going to Oh, and I would also do something that I see people do often when they start performing just by themselves, if they've been in a sketch group or improv, where I would do like character stuff,
okay,
which can be amazingly funny and great, and there are people who are wonderful at it, but I found that I started enjoying myself more and getting more laughs as over the years I shifted into talking things that I truly cared about and believed about and were really from my heart. In the beginning, I was weirder and more esoteric and fantastical and stuff. But now, and then in the ensuing years, thank goodness, you know, life has happened to me. Like, I got sober in 2002. In 2003, started to the process of dealing with very serious depression. Then after that, I met my wife and we got married, and now we have two kids. And so now I have a lot more that I am crazy about in this world and happy about and angry about and all that, which you need to do stand-up. So now when I do stuff, I have an idea of what I want to talk about, but as many stand-ups do once they've been doing it for a while, I write on stage, so to speak, and I've got hopefully decades more in which to grow and improve, but I find that the funniest stuff that I do comes when I approach an idea from a passionate perspective on stage with a few ideas about what I might talk about.
Sure.
And
You know. So when you, I mean, I think it's easy to see that passion when you're talking about your history, the experiences in prison. And
I never went to prison.
Oh, sorry. Under the care of.
I went to jail.
Okay, I'm sorry. To me, I think to an English person, those things
right. Really, well, prison is like, maybe you don't make it out. I mean, prison in the United States of America, you don't want to go. Okay. Jail, you don't want to go, but like, you'll probably get out alive.
Okay. So when you were describing those things, those experiences on stage, and when you're describing your relationship with your children, how much you love your children, sniffing babies' necks and so forth, it's easy to see the... you know, wanting to eat your child, that kind of... I think that's fantastic material because that it's such an odd angle on the idea of loving a child, but it works well because people can kind of go, I sort of do feel a bit that myself.
Yeah, you know, the thing is it's like, it's so... Should I try to not swear on this?
It doesn't matter at all.
Okay, perfect. I'll try not to. But anyway, like, I get so sick of seeing, especially like in sitcoms, where you'll see a comedian or whatever, an actor, be like, my wife, you know, kill her. Fucking kill her and then kill yourself. I don't want to hear that shit. And nobody really feels that way. If they do, the marriage ends or they get divorced or they kill each other. And so that's so not real to me, but it's so pervasive, you know?
Sure.
Whereas with my wife, like, I'm crazy about her. I would marry her again tomorrow. Yet, I've envisioned her death many times.
Sure.
Like, particularly, we hike a lot. We camp in, like, national forests. I've thought about, like, what would happen if I pushed her off, you know? Probably wouldn't get caught, but I know that this way that I feel right now is crazy, and I do love her, and so I'd probably be consumed by guilt, and I go like 10 years into the future imagining, you know, like why I shouldn't kill her. You know, I have to like reverse engineer why I shouldn't kill her, you know what I mean? And she does the same things too. I mean, she said things to me that have come out of her mouth, and I'm like, I haven't heard that in a Quentin Tarantino movie. I haven't heard, I mean, that is hate. That wasn't in the Old Testament. And she said, I'm like, I can't. But then I look at what I did and I'm like, oh, I deserved to hear that from her, you know?
Okay.
But at the same time, like, she's beautiful when we met. She's more beautiful. Like, I look at my wife and I'm like, are you kidding me? I'm like, are you kidding me? When I look at her, amazing beauty. And I, you know, then see, but the thing is what I'm describing is like, that's a real marriage, that's a real relationship, you know what I mean? Like, where you run the gamut. So I try to explore that more in my stand-up, realer stuff, you know? Or like a comedian being like, damn, my kids, yeah, they're driving me crazy, you know? Then put them in a bus and drive off a hill.
Sure.
Nobody, you know, then why did you have them?
So you do recognize that you're coming from quite an unusual position within comedy of talking about things in a positive way, whereas it's a much easier trope for a comedian, or a much more prevalent trope, to attack things. Is it harder to write positively about stuff you love when there's an easier laugh to be had from knocking something and going, this is terrible, I hate it?
Not for me, because and I am grateful for the stuff, for like for having gone through the experience that I went through, because now, like, I really feel like I kind of got up to like membrane that separates the dead from the living, and like really kind of like pushed on it, and it was like, I'm gonna break, and I was like, oh, okay, you know. And so now when I do stuff, I just try to do the best that I can and tell the deepest truth that I can, because like, you guys deserve it. You're good people who made an effort to come here. Why would I waste your fucking time? Why would I do that to you? You know what I mean? Like, there's things I'm angry about, but it isn't individual human people. You know, it's like institutions. It's like systemic racism that you don't even notice at first. And you're like, oh, that's the devil, right? Mm. You know what I mean? Like, things that, you know, so there's things that I hate and want to fight with a hammer, but it's not individual human people that I love, you know? Like, sure. So I do consider myself like a humanist. And there's things that I get angry about. God knows I'm filthy. You know what I mean? Like, I remember when my first stand-up special was in the can, I was like, holy shit, my mom is going to see this. And I just tried to think of, like, people I've heard say more disgusting things than me. And it was kind of a short list. I mean, I've heard, like, Bill Hicks say things that are worse and more graphic and disgusting. Patrice O'Neill. Dave Attell, you know, I mean, but not a lot of, sure. I haven't heard a lot of people say.
So where does that stuff come from? Like, 5 minutes into your special, you're talking about, I don't like to fuck people in the butt. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a very explicit and graphic and straight off.
Yes.
They're very early in. So is that a byproduct of the fact that you're mining yourself for truth very intensely? So
that bit, like, sort of the enemy, and I don't always identify the enemy in a bit. I think in that one I do a little bit, but that's guys who are like pressuring their young girlfriends into like, no, people, everybody fucks in the, it's normal, and that you wouldn't want me to fuck you in the ass is weird, Susie. Like, it's those guys who are like frat guys or whatever who are like, no, I totally should fuck, it's my birthday, you know. And I'm like, those people are monsters, you know. So I talk about one a couple times, you know, whatever. Shut up, where things have gone in my butt. And, you know, I didn't like it. So I tried to relate that, you know. And,
but it's interesting that you take the victim of the joke, the victim being those kind of frat boys, you take them out of the joke. So again, it's very positive.
Well, I'm just trying to, like, it's so easy to like, I want my target to be, like, the Goliaths, you know what I mean? And in this case, Goliath is a aggressive anal sex desirer, you know, who isn't. If you want to have anal sex, please have it all the time, but you have to want it. And the recipient of the thing going in their butt has to be like, this is exactly what I want right now. And it shouldn't be some like youngster who's like, okay, Steve, you know, I mean, like, that's horrible. So that's what I was talking about in that thing. So yeah, that's one of my causes.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
So this is Rob. I was really struck by how charming he is and how much time he had for me and for the people after his gig the previous night. It was a really funny, very fascinating show. And if you missed him in the UK or wherever you are, you can download his comedy special from robdelaney.com and also his new book, which is entitled Rob Delaney, Mother, Wife, Sister, Human, Warrior, Falcon, Yardstick, Turban, Cabbage. So get stuck into that. I'm very pleased with this interview. It can sometimes be the case that comics who are interviewed a lot can settle into their regular gig stories and sound bites and so on. But I think Rob really opened up. We got some very fresh stuff here, so many thanks to him for being so candid. Plus, of course, we've got some very specific insight coming up into the way Rob uses Twitter and the way he makes the most of it professionally. All really good stuff. Thanks as ever for your donations. If you're a new listener, maybe if you got into this show through Rob and you've not heard before, then just to explain, before I became a comic myself, I used to be a street performer at Covent Garden, and I'm very much following a busking model with this show. So if you go to www.comedianscomedian.com, you can click on the PayPal donate button there and contribute to the running of the podcast and the ruinous costs of taking it to the Edinburgh Festival as a live show. Just like a street show, the amount that you pay is entirely up to you, and I'm fond of imagining that the people who can afford it pay for the people who can't. Any amount is fine by me. People who paid a pound a show in the past, or some people have just plucked a figure from the air. To the students who occasionally, bless you, chip in with a fiver or a tenner here or there, please stop apologising for doing that. I'm so grateful. You don't owe me anything. I appreciate not everyone's rich. Payment is by no means mandatory, but thank you nonetheless. I really appreciate all of your donations. If you don't wish to donate, of course, that's fine. You can still look me in the eye. But maybe you would like to rate the show on iTunes or just share it with someone who's never heard it before. That's all for now. Let's get back to Mr. Rob Delaney.
So we were talking about the fact that so much of your material is very scatological and
true. Yeah, maybe I'll grow out of that because I am a young stand-up. You know, sure, I've been writing and performing and doing different things for longer than 10 years, but stand-up just 10 years. So I'm young stand-up. And maybe I'll get out of that. But I am very fascinated by bodies and sexual politics and just goo. And, you know, having recently, you know, my oldest son is 2.5. We have a 6-month-old as well. So watching my wife's body transform and go through pregnancy and seeing two bodies develop, and you know, watching my own body deteriorate as I get older and take poorer care of it. So I do, and the body's a great laboratory to talk about like our deepest fears, you know.
Sure.
So the body can kind of be like a secret way, like people you can really talk about a lot by talking about the body. You know, really get to much. It can be a great springboard. So I am puerile and sophomoric and scatological. Happily, maybe I'll get out of that one day, but I'm still very curious about stuff there.
So it's less about shocking individual audiences or rooms full of people, and it's more about using the body stuff to connect with everyone, because we can all appreciate that we've all got a body.
Yeah, definitely. And you can't shock people. I mean, come on. I don't think I've ever said anything where anybody was like, "What?" Like, I never conceived of that. You know. Sure. And
but in relation to a lot of other stand-ups, you recognize that.
Yeah, I guess I am. You know, yeah.
If you're worried about your mother hearing it, then there's got to be an element, presumably, of.
But you know what's funny is that she would see things that I wrote, like articles, or she'd see stuff on Twitter, or she'd see short sets of my stand-up, and she would call me and be like, why and I'd be like, because that's what's happening, I'm gonna keep on doing it, you can call me or not, but not. And then
there a first time that happened when you, or it was the first time you thought, if I say this at some point, my mom's gonna say it and I have to be fine with that because I'm an artist?
Yeah, but I can't pinpoint it. I'm not sure. Okay. But then when she did see my special in one thing, when she sat down and saw that, and she saw like the story that I was telling and what I was trying to do with it, she's like, "Oh, I get it now." You know, she's like, "You're not just a monster. You're a monster who has flashes of wanting to do good things and help people."
Okay.
From time to time.
Sure. So do you feel like we've talked about the material a little bit? Do you feel that your persona on stage is very like the real you? I mean, the way we're talking now, and I admit this is a sort of a stage situation. This isn't kind of normal life. How much of your real self is there in the persona that we see on stage?
Pretty much. I mean, I dial it up a little, but I really feel that way. I mean, like, for example, there was a bit last night, I don't know if you remember, where I rail against architects and my perceived notion that they're pretentious. You know, I just happen to know some pretentious architects, and I actually know a lot of architects, and some of them are very good friends of mine, so it could be I could be looking in the mirror with that bit, but I don't want to get that personal right now. But like, so do I really hate architects? No, I certainly don't. But do I look at certain architects from time to time and think, "You fucking knob," you know? Yeah, I do.
Sure.
And I don't viscerally hate them.
So before a show, do you kind of ever sort of put your face on, so to speak? Or do you just, are you an act that can just kind of go, "Oh, I'm on, right, I'll just walk on because it's you"?
Yeah, I just walk on.
Sure.
I might, you know, because doing an hour of stand-up, as you know, is physically challenging, you know, I might, like, run up and down a flight of stairs a few times or do some jumping jacks just so that I'm, you know, ready to go. But I don't.
But there's no sense that there's the character of Rob Delaney is different.
No.
To that. Okay. Mm-hmm. So what's the relationship between your persona on stage and your persona as a user of Twitter? Because you, more than most comedians, I think, have... Twitter is such a part of your profile, such a part of your outlet.
Sure.
You've got close to 1 million followers now.
It's nuts.
And it is nuts. And I just wonder, because obviously the style of Twitter and the fact you're confined to 140 characters and the work you do on Twitter, do you feel like there's a big difference between the work you do on Twitter and the work you do... thanks, man. Yeah, thanks, Rob Delaney.
Sorry.
That's totally cool.
For
the benefit of the listener,
there.
Rob Delaney is a selfish asshole.
Do you want some of this?
Because, no, I'm cool.
Okay,
that's fine.
I don't have any diseases or anything, but anyway, okay.
So we're talking about... do you feel there's a difference in your voice?
Yeah, Twitter is just dilly-dallying and silly, and I say whatever I want on Twitter. I say things that I don't believe. I say things that are outrageous and insane. Generally, if I say something on stage, I believe it or a version of it. If I say it on Twitter, I don't. It's just Twitter is get laughs at all costs, you know? And I kind of enjoy that because you can assume, I mean, I write in like different personalities.
Sure.
I'll do a tonal shift from like writing a ridiculous, filthy thing that's horrible that nobody would, I hope, ever say, and then switch to like a passionate defense of Obamacare, you know, or something like that, like an article in The Guardian about why we need it, you know? And I don't care about having it be a cohesive thing. Twitter is like a sort of, you know, the flux capacitor in the Back to the Future, you know, at the end when they put the new thing on it where you can power
Mr. Fusion.
Mr. Fusion. You can put in like orange peels, or you can put in garbage, or you can put in a can of oil, or you can put in a microphone. It doesn't matter. That's what I feel like Twitter is. Just put in whatever. And,
And was that a decision? Have you always felt that? Or when you first discovered it, did you go, oh, great, I can do anything?
Well, I guess I sort of, in the beginning, I wanted it to be just jokes because I noticed other comedians were using it to communicate and be like, hey, Rick, you want to grab a burrito? You know, and I thought, well, no, maybe I think it should just be like sort of a calling where you can visit my page and you guarantee jokes, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's mostly what I still do now. But I don't feel like... I don't feel the pressure to have like a unified personality. I don't care that it's all disparate, wacky stuff. I do want it to be entertaining.
Sure.
I don't post stuff like, whoa, traffic's bad today.
Sure.
Like, because that's a terrible thing to do to people. Again, if you're aware that people are following you, you know, why would you do that? You know, it's like when you get on stage, you have to do a good job. You have to. You people took time out of your day, you know, to come here. So on Twitter, I try to be, at the worst case scenario, be like interesting, you know, and not just talk about like, you know, they've really got a great omelet at Barry's Omelet Shack. Like, who cares?
And do you, I read somewhere that you actually, you kind of redress, you'll look back at your Twitter feed on your page and if something hasn't got enough retweets, you'll delete it.
Adios. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and that's a good ego reducer thing too, because kill your baby. And then, because you don't want to be precious about material, you know, like you just get rid of it.
Do you ever want to be as free on stage to chuck everything into Mr. Fusion as you can be on Twitter?
I don't know. I mean, I feel free on stage, but I do feel a responsibility to talk about stuff that I'm more excited about. Like, I'll do a joke on Twitter that I think, like, I don't really believe this. This isn't the funniest thing I've ever thought of.
Sure.
It's just silly. It's super specific. It has limited, whatever. I'll put that on there. Whereas on stand-up, I want to be funny. Like, there was an old debate. It's pretty much dead in the United States now, though, between, like, the club comics and the alt comics, you know?
Okay.
Where, and any comedian worth anything, you know, was like, well, no, you have to be funny in both. If you're funny at the Upright Citizens Brigade in downtown New York City, and you're not funny at the Topeka Kansas improv, then you're not funny. Sure. So I try to do stuff on stage where it's like, if it's funny to a group of men, but it's not funny to a group of women, not funny. Funny to a group of white people, but not funny to a group of black people, not funny. And I don't put jokes through that filter, but I do try to just spend my creative time in a place where my jokes are like totally debased, filthy, insane, bonkers garbage, but garbage that can be enjoyed by everybody. You know what I mean?
And given that there is some sort of strategy to, like, if you're going back and deleting ones so that your page is a calling card full of jokes, mm-hmm. are there other strategic things you do with Twitter? Do you ever schedule tweets? Do you ever come up with a tweet and then do it later?
If I come up with one in like the middle of the night, you know, like, then, and I know really nobody will see it, then I will do it, except like Australian people, you know, so I will do that one when I wake up, you know. Okay. But other than that, no, I don't schedule them. I just try to do it whenever I think of them.
And do you have a sense that Twitter is kind of a free-for-all creatively? Because I've noticed one of the things that a lot of American comics in particular that I follow, mm-hmm. and other comics in the UK, there are certain tropes. There's certain kind of...
Sure.
Obviously there's lots of different joke formats, but one of the tropes on Twitter, for example, is to answer a question that some awful Burger King hack has posted and answer it in a way... No, you know, I've seen Eddie Pepitone do that. I've seen you do that. I've seen... someone like Neil Hamburger do that.
The champion.
Yeah, I mean, he's phenomenal at doing that.
So great.
He's great. So is there a sense that those formats are available to everybody? Because, I mean, if you didn't invent that, do you feel comfortable like, oh, that's one of the things we can all do?
Yeah, definitely feel comfortable doing that. And I see things that I may have, you know, that I think I did first that other people do. Great.
What sort of things do you think you did first?
I can't think of a single one.
Okay. Yeah.
Can't think of
a
single one.
I'm not trying to challenge you as to whether or not that's accurate, but I'm aware that you and Neil, I think, have really, I'm using Neil as if he's a real person, mm-hmm. but I think you have really developed how people use Twitter.
I don't know. I mean, you know, he certainly is a wonderful influence on me that I am insane about. And that is a great thing about Twitter, though, is, you know, you see the influence. It's very fluid and people sharing ideas and joke concepts and stuff. And I think it's beautiful. I remember talking to Graham Linehan like 3 years ago, mm-hmm. and he was saying, like, you know, he's like, I think Peter Serafinovich might have used up all the jokes.
Yeah, sure.
Like, he might have used them all up. Yeah. And I remember thinking, you know, he really might have, you know? And, but now here it is 3 years later, and I'm still seeing things that are just unbelievably mm-hmm. creative. Mm-hmm. And who would have thought? I mean, 140 characters, but the things that people continually come up with, quite beautiful. There are beautiful tweets. It's insane to say that, but there are beautiful tweets, you know?
Sure.
That's crazy.
I was talking to, I interviewed Greg Proops a couple of weeks ago mm-hmm. on this podcast, and he was talking about how his podcast has changed the way he thinks about stand-up, whereas previously he believed stand-up was the most direct method of addressing an audience.
Yeah.
And now he feels like he's not sure whether it's the stand-up or the podcast that's mm-hmm. most direct. And I wondered if there was is something parallel there with the way you use Twitter. Is there one method of either Twitter or stand-up that you feel is the most direct means of contacting someone?
Stand-up, I feel like... Well, Twitter, you know, we'll see how long it's around. You know what I mean? No social network has lived forever, and likely none will. And Twitter is certainly a new way to use the internet. And it is my favorite one, and it's one that I owe a tremendous debt of gratitude to. That said, stand-up, like, I've started to sweat. You know, I think there's like sweat in my armpits right now, under my breasts. Sweat may become visible soon. And if we stayed here for a little while longer, people would be able to start to smell me. You know what I mean? That's very powerful.
Sure.
You can't smell me.
You have a very powerful
Twitter.
Scent.
Yeah, but like after the show, I can touch people. You know what I mean? Like, you could, like, if I came on stage and we'd had a fight beforehand and you could see that there were tears in my eyes, you know what I mean? Like, you can't see that on Twitter. Usually I am crying when I tweet, but like, you know what I mean? Like, there's such an intimacy to stand up and the fact that it typically isn't recorded and that it is ephemeral, you know, and that you're going to tell a joke to your friend later and you're going to misremember a little bit of it.
Sure.
That's amazing. You know what I mean? Because it's transformed inside of you. That's very special, you know. So I think that live stand-up is if the power went out in this building, that'd be okay. I could put the mic down and I could just stand in the middle of everybody and yell at them and they would still hear me. If Twitter goes out, this is done, you know?
Yeah.
So stand-up, I believe, is a lot more powerful and special than Twitter, as great as I think Twitter is.
Are you able to answer anything? I mean, if with 900,000 followers or so, you mm-hmm. must get at messages that, I mean, for you, it must be just a flood where you can just dip in or not.
That is accurate. Yeah, it is more. I cannot read them all. I used to be able to, but okay. I can't anymore. So I think that's the answer.
Yep. So I wanted to talk to you about whether you feel like your audience. Now, obviously, you've talked about you can use Twitter to mm-hmm. help manufacture a live audience.
Yes.
And I wanted to talk to you about whether you consider that live audience that sees you because of Twitter, whether what they get from your stand-up mm-hmm. is the same, is what they're expecting. Mm-hmm. Do you have some sense that they know you won't just be doing one-liners?
Yeah, because, and this is weird, and this might surprise you to hear it from me, but Twitter has like improved my idea about the human race, because most of the people that interact with me, the majority of them are kind, sensitive, well-read, funny people. And so, and my shows cost money. They're not usually free. So people put in a little homework and they'll typically watch my stand up before mm-hmm. they come, you know? So people, yeah, generally know what they're going to see. If anybody has thought they were going to see me do tweets and then came to a show, they haven't told me that.
Sure.
People have asked me online rather than do their own homework, or maybe they don't have Google. They've said, are you going to read your tweets on stage? And, you know, I don't answer those questions anymore.
But I
don't, by the way. People are smart and savvy, and they know that they're going to see stand-up.
Sure, but in terms of the difference that we said might exist between your voice mm-hmm. on Twitter and your voice in stand-up.
Yes.
So do you get the sense that people are expecting a more freewheeling version of you, the Mr. Fusion idea?
No, I don't think so. My guess is that they've actually seen me do stand-up online or something like that. That they did see me. Or, you know, because I post clips of stuff, you know, mm-hmm. online a lot. And so I think people are smarter than I would have thought they were.
Sure.
You know?
Okay. Do you, in fact, because we're running out of time-ish, we've got about sort of 10, 15 minutes more. If there's anyone that would like to ask a question, feel free to put a hand up and we can come to you for questions. What normally happens here is there's a bit of an eggy pause while the audience goes, ooh, we might have to participate. just feel free to be thinking of a question while I ask a few more. Do you feel on stage that there are things you see, say, other comedians doing that you think, mm-hmm. I wish I was better at doing that particular nuance of stand-up?
Yes.
Are there parts of stand-up? Are there like strings to the bow that you find intangible at the moment that you're aiming towards?
Definitely, yeah.
What kind of stuff? Because you're so assured on stage. You've got such an imagination. What is there that you go, I haven't quite got there?
I did a show recently with Bill Burr in Los Angeles, and he did a killer set. And he did this one thing where he was sort of playing in time, and a joke had flashbacks in it. So he was like bending time in a joke over, by the way, like millennia. And I want to be able to do stuff like that. I now want to play with time the way a wizard might. So that was very special. And I definitely want to... I'm working on becoming more physically animated. Yes, the material is, of course, very important, but the way that you deliver it is perhaps more important, you know? So I am trying to... use more of the stage, use more of my voice. I'm trying to, if I think, I used to try to dumb down things. Like if I was like, if a word had like five syllables, I'd be like, well, pull it. You know, what if somebody doesn't know it? Now I'm getting to the point where I'm like, fuck them. They can go pick up a dictionary.
Okay.
And so I'm trying not to like, you know, sell short an audience.
Sure.
Or, you know, if 40% of the audience knows a big word, then good for them. They get to laugh at it and the idiots don't.
Okay.
So I feel like I'm only beginning to figure out how stand-up works. And I think that's consistent with having done it for 10 years, you know, that's, sure. which sounds like a long time in some trades, but in stand up, any idiot yeah. will tell you it's not a long time.
Sure. So do you feel that you were, I mean, do you feel that Twitter has kind of catapulted you beyond where you might otherwise be as a stand up?
Without question. Absolutely. Because if I first did stand up in 2002 and then I joined Twitter in 2009, mm-hmm. you know, absolutely. Because I was headlining in 2009 when I joined mm-hmm. for like no money, you mm-hmm. know, and in tiny clubs and stuff. And now I, you know, I'm sure there would have been some growth, you know, between sure. over the last 4 years without Twitter, but no question Twitter shot me out of a powerful cannon
sure.
and got me to places I wouldn't have otherwise got.
Sure. And yet it kind of the way it did that was by you making jokes, as opposed to, as sometimes happens to other comedians, what catapults them is like an appearance in a movie or mm-hmm. a sitcom or something. It's almost yeah. like the thing itself is what propelled you.
Well, and I made sure to just always be performing, you know, and because that's the only way you get better. You don't get better at stand-up by doing Twitter or by doing anything other than lots of stand-up.
Sure.
So I'm always, whether I'm writing a book or writing for TV or doing whatever, I'm always doing stand-up because you can't rest with stand-up, you
sure.
know? It's like a shark. You got to keep yeah. moving. You have to keep ripping off kids' arms and stuff at the beach, you know?
Do you ever find that with the stuff that we mentioned before about the kind of scatological stuff or the embarrassing kind of wanking with a finger up your asshole kind of stuff?
Sure.
Do you ever find that that's embarrassing? Does it cost you anything to say that on stage?
Not really. But the thing is I can be embarrassed. Like, everybody has... I've learned that, like... Everybody has a certain amount of being embarrassed that they have to go through, and mine manifests in the weirdest ways. Like,
okay.
I was at a wedding not too long ago, and there was a buffet, and instead of a plate to go through the buffet, I took a thing that in America we call it a charger, which is like a decorative thing that goes like under a plate,
yeah.
and I took the wrong thing. So I took like a comically big plate, and I was like, I was thinking like, why is this plate so big? Oh, I better just go do it. And then I went through, and somebody was like, that's not a plate, and I was like... And I was like, I wanted to cry. And
okay.
I was like, why am I so embarrassed by this? And I realized it's like, it just, I guess my embarrassment had to blast out sideways in some weird way. Whereas I'm totally, absolutely comfortable talking about my finger way up my asshole. I did it in front of my godmother in Boston a couple weeks ago. And after the show, she was like, that was terrific. And I was like, I'm
sure.
sorry. I'm so sorry.
And with someone who's mining their life as you do
mm-hmm.
For those kind of stories about your childhood, stories about your family, mm-hmm. stories about your younger life, do you ever worry that you'll run out of stories to tell? Do you ever have a kind of a creeping terror that like, oh, what if I run out of things that have happened?
Yes, but it hasn't happened yet, you know. And I think if you continue living, you know, you can't be only performing, and you've got to be living, you've got to be out there aspiring, you've got to be out there growing, getting hurt, you know. Mm. And so my life is so dynamic and insane now, especially having two young kids, you know, the mm-hmm. amount of effort and energy that you have to put in
yeah.
to a 2.5-year-old and a 6-year-old and maintain a marriage, which is very difficult when you have two sure. kids who demand so much from you. So my life is certainly interesting right now. And by being honest about that, by being honest about what I care about, what I'm afraid of, mm-hmm. you know, I think I'm living my life in a way right now that will generate material for at least the near to intermediate term future,
mm-hmm.
you know,
okay.
10 years from now, who knows?
Sure. So before we sort of move on to the audience, I just wanted to ask about your depression.
Okay.
As someone who I suffer from anxiety and mm-hmm. anxiety attacks, I used to think I was depressed, but actually looking
okay.
back at it, I can kind of go, I think that was actually kind of critical anxiety.
Okay.
You suffer from as I understand it, clinical depression.
Uh-huh.
You're using medication for it.
Correct.
And I wondered how much of that drove you to do your work and whether the work that you've done has helped deal with it. Because I know there's a lot mm-hmm. of comedians who kind of, there is an idea, and I think it sort of bears scrutiny, to be honest, that some comedians are sort of deficient somehow or sad in their own lives
mm-hmm.
and they can reach out and contact people, they can have a focus, they can have a job to focus on, they can always be doing that, can occupy their time. But that seems to me like a non-clinical kind of appreciation of it.
Yeah.
And I wonder with someone who suffers as the depression that you do, which mm-hmm. I know is to a very severe extent, whether there is still that parallel, what relationship it has to your work.
Yeah, it definitely has a relationship. I mean, for example, like going on stage for me is it does feel therapeutic with a lowercase t. Like it feels like getting into a jacuzzi, and that's weird, right? But if I do it, and the only I've had two very serious episodes of depression in my life, and during the second one, the only time that I would feel like marginally human was when I was on stage, because there was like enough of an endorphin kick to like bring me to like near normal, you know. But then, so, and the pursuit, the forward motion, the inertia, just the, if you keep, you know, moving forward in something, that helps depression.
Sure.
So, working, you know, helps with depression, for me. And then also, yeah, it does inform the way that I work, because now I'm not afraid of things that are outside of my own skull, you know? And I said, then jail and all the broken limbs and stuff helped with that. Like, I'm not afraid of people. What are they going to do? Break my limbs with a baseball bat? I know I can handle that. You know sure. what I mean? I'm afraid of like my own like cranial circuitry, you know, sure. like convincing me of things that are, you know, out there. So, my mom and I were talking about it, strolling on the beach in Massachusetts a few weeks ago. Like, I'm not afraid of Jaws. I'm afraid of like The Exorcist. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like,
okay.
So on stage, for example, I'm not really afraid of like, oh, if I said something controversial, what are people going to do? Blog about it and then forget about it. I don't care, you know, that doesn't faze me. Or if I'm in a meeting with producers or whatever and they're like, oh, I don't know about your blah blah blah, I'm like, great, I couldn't care less, you know what I mean? So that is useful in the so if you are thinking of going into entertainment, you know, it would help to have something really horrible happen inside your own spirit before you begin.
And does that hold true for if you're on stage and a gig is going badly? Assuming that still happens for
well,
you.
I don't, of course I don't like that. And yes, of course it still happens sometimes, but I rebound from it very quickly, whereas I used to not. So there's that. I feel like a professional responsibility, but I don't feel like if a gig is going south, I'm not like, oh my God, I'm losing my mind. I'm now at least after a decade, I'm like, all right, how do we get out of this? You know what I mean? And it's very useful. It's very, you learn a lot when you bomb, you know. I'm excited to do, I will likely learn more from my shows at Reading and Leeds than I will from my ones at Edinburgh and London. Because these I'm doing at a proper theater for people who have come specifically to see me. You know what I mean? So they're going to give me the benefit of the doubt out of the gate, which is enough for me to enjoy myself and just keep trucking, you know, throughout the whole show. Reading and Leeds, there are people going to be like, what's this? You know, and then come in and I'm going to hear other bands playing. And
you're going to have a horrible tent experience potentially.
Yeah, it'll be hard. And I've had festival experiences, but I usually say yes to festivals because I like to have like a shitty, physically difficult, like acoustically terrible situation, because you have to learn how to adapt. And then my theater show after that, you know, it will be better because you have to perform under adverse circumstances. And so I'm very, very grateful for where I am in my career right now, and I want to make sure that gratitude manifests itself forever by saying yes to uncomfortable situations, because you can't get too comfortable in stand-up or you will suck, and that is it would be tragic.
Thank you. If anyone does have a question, there is one in there. Thank you very much. Can you imagine life without stand-up now?
I really can't. I cannot. It would be, I don't know what I would do. That would put my survival into question. Like, I love to write. I just wrote a book. I write lots of stuff. I do other, you know, act and other stuff like that, which I love to do all that, but not with the insane passion of stand up. So, yeah, so no, I can't, and I don't want to either, because I love it. I just love it so much.
So what do you get out of comedic performance that you don't get out of musical performance?
Well, he also asked.
Yeah, he did. I was expecting you to be able to fold into that. What was the slightly
what
more kind of Wikipedia question
was
of what
was
the
touring show? It was Camelot, and I played Sir Lancelot in it, and it toured the United States for a little under a year in 99 and 2000. And you know, I'll tell you an experience that sort of illustrates it pretty neatly. I enjoy doing that. I mean, it's fun to get up in front of 2,500 people and sing big songs and wear armor and use a sword. That's fun. Like that's pure. No, that's not fun for most people. So, but one day our bus broke down in Virginia when we were on our way to the University of West Virginia to perform at a big theater, and our set on the two trucks got to the theater, as did our crew, which had driven through the last night to get there. But all the actors were on the side of the road, and so they sent another bus for us. We got to the theater at like 7:16 p.m. and the show was supposed to start at 7. So there's 2,500 people in this auditorium, sold out, and myself, Lancelot, and Guinevere and King Arthur, we have to do sound check because we have to just make sure that acoustically our mics and the orchestras are in, you know, harmony, so that there isn't horrible feedback or any whatever. So Arthur goes out and he talks, says a few lines of dialogue from the play, and then does some bars of music, and which is what we always did every night. And then Guinevere, and then I came out and I was like, they had said lines of dialogue, but I was like, well, no, these people came here, and I don't want to spoil it. Not like they all probably don't all have it fucking memorized, but like you're tattooed on their weird musical theater fan bodies. But I went out there and I was like, oh, so I guess I'll just talk, you know, I'll just talk. And so in front of 2,500 people, I told a story about our day by the side of this river, and people laughed. And when I heard 2,500 people laugh, I literally that second I was like, fuck musicals. Fuck them. I mean, it was such a greater high. Usually they'd be clapping for a song that some guy wrote 50 years ago, which more power to him. That's amazing, you know. But when they clap for things that I thought up, I was like, ooh, yeah. I mean, literally, it was like a guy who smokes pot getting like a shot of clean heroin in like the jugular vein. I was like, yeah, this is the good stuff.
With that in mind, do you feel like you'd do anything to get a laugh, to get that kind of hit? Or do you feel that you've got responsibilities as a citizen or a man? There's certain things you shouldn't say, even though they could get a laugh.
Well, to sort of dissect that question, you can, subject-wise, you can talk about anything, but it's the way that you do it. So I wouldn't, if I saw an opportunity, you know, if I saw like a softball coming down the line, or softball, that's a fastball, a nice fat pitch. I'm afraid to use baseball metaphors, but anyway, and I was like, oh my God, I could hit that out of the park by saying that this guy's a fucking idiot or whatever, like, you know, and I would not do that because I don't want to hurt people, you know, with jokes. And humor's powerful. You totally can. So I do believe in humor being to bring people together, to like break down social barriers, to help. So I can't think of like an example, but I wouldn't say something to hurt somebody. I wouldn't cut somebody down just to bring myself up,
sure,
you know, because
sure,
why? Life's okay, painful enough.
I wanted to talk to you with that in mind. I just wanted to talk to you finally before we wrap up about your views on feminism and your views on your material about women that you use, which because your material is very celebratory, it kind of like you use very graphic imagery about your wife's body,
yes,
and about your wife's genitals and about, yes, women's genitals.
Yes.
And I just want to, I think that like from stuff that I've read of you online, I feel like very comfortable that you're a feminist and that you're very pro women. And yet I wonder, given how graphic the imagery is, I wonder whether you need to sell it in such a way that do you need to remind us that you're pro women as you do it?
Well, let me ask you. I mean, you saw the show last night. Did you feel that I did that? Because certainly my goal is to let the ideas speak for themselves, you know? So I don't think, like, because I'm going to leave here and go do that show again. And I talk about, I do pretty explicitly slam misogyny in the form of a couple young guys, and this is true, that I heard complaining about, you know, or celebrating the fact that he'd never heard his girlfriend fart or poop, and I talk about why that's terrible, and sure, like he should want her to have a functioning gastrointestinal tract and all that stuff. But no, you know, honestly, I feel like my act, the hour that I'm doing now, is pretty like organically pro women. And there is an element of affirmative action there, because I love affirmative action. You know what I mean? Especially like in the United States, like with affirmative action to help African-American people, you know, after slavery and stuff like that. I think it's a wonderful thing. And, you know, I say that as a white guy, you know, whose Irish ancestors came over here well after slavery was over. But if something happens and it's systemic and terrible and horrible and lasts for centuries, then I think it's okay to have a systemic solution like affirmative action, you know? And so for me, being like a white heterosexual male comic, I think that it is good at minimum, I enjoy like upping women. I think things are funnier because I think that women are filthy and terrible people just like men, and they want the opportunity to laugh just as hard about body crazy things. I mean, like BAWDY. And like I said earlier about the alt versus club comic debate, and you know, if it's funny to a group of men and it's not funny to a group of women, it's not funny. And I believe that. And I had the very good fortune to always be seeing the Upright Citizens Brigade perform over the years, and they were, although their four person makeup is 75% male, 25% women, that woman being Amy Poehler, they would as a rule perform with a bunch more women, so it was closer to a 50-50 ratio. And that was when I learned that the funniest thing in the world is not a group of men and it's not a group of women, it's men and women together. So, you know, there are people who say like, I'm not a feminist, I'm a humanist. I do identify as a feminist because I think that and it's more of like a robotic utilitarian feminism. Like, there's fucking more women on Earth than there are men. The world is going to be a better place if they're happier and have more opportunities. So I don't set out being like, well, let's do an hour of material that the women are going to really like. Like, that would be a terrible hour of comedy.
Sure.
But I just try to make sure that my heart is in the right place when I do stuff. And I don't care what is dangling or tucked up or some combination of the two between your legs. If you're at one of my shows, I would like you to enjoy yourself and feel comfortable, happy, you know, expanded, added to, not subtracted from at one of my shows. Even though I am an abject scumbag, that is one of my overarching goals.
Thank you very much. That's all we've got time for. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Rob Delaney. Thank you very much.
So that was Rob. Thank you so much to Rob Delaney for coming along. He wasn't in town for long at all, and I enjoyed his company very much indeed. I thought it was a great interview. Thank you to James Lowy for technical support, and James and Anthony at So Television, who produced the show in Edinburgh. And thanks to Nathan Wood, who co-produced this episode. Thank you, Nathan. Finally, of course, if you'd like to read Rob Delaney's new book, it's available online for about $8.99 in the UK. But if you like the sound of his voice as well as the cut of his jib, why not download the audiobook from Audible for free and hear him read it himself? All you need to do is go to audible.co.uk/cc for Comedians Comedian and sign up to their membership scheme. You get a free download to start you off, and you can also cancel your subscription anytime you like. But maybe you'd care to stay. You might find that that these audiobooks start whiling away the long drive. They certainly do for me. Putting that /cc on the address doesn't change the offer at all for you. It just means that this podcast gets a small additional donation, which is very welcome indeed. So you get something for free, and you get to say thanks for the show. If you are listening in America, I'm guessing that audible.com/cc might work as well. I don't know if it does. Try.co.uk, see how you go. That's all for now. We're back very soon with another great guest. Remember, you can always email me at info@comedianscomedian.com. I really enjoy reading your emails. Or you can tweet me at ComComPod. And I'll talk to you very soon. Bye for now.